From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We have a holiday concert for you with singer and pianist Charles Brown. He was a rhythm and blues star in the 40s and 50s. Now his music's being rediscovered. Also today, Rick Bass talks about his life of solitude, writing in a cabin high in the Montana wilderness. Bass's latest book chronicles the years he spent as a geologist hunting for oil. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Miami's TK Productions, the recording studio responsible for acts like George McRae and KC and the Sunshine Band. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Back to the Future 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Happy Thanksgiving. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. At least 250,000 and as many as 500,000 people gathered in Prague's Wenceslas Square today, demanding democratic reforms. It was the seventh straight day of protests in that country's capital city. The state-run news agency carried an army statement today saying security forces may crack down against the rallies to defend Czechoslovakia from anarchy. The Communist Party in East Germany has opened investigations against former leader Erich Honecker for his conduct in office. Deidre Berger reports from Berlin.
The Control Commission of East Germany's Communist Party today said it was looking into abuses of power by its former chief, Erich Honecker. It is doubtful whether the former party leader will be brought to trial due to his poor state of health. The Communist Party today also threw out Gunther Mittag, a former member of the ruling Politburo, who was in charge of the economy. Evidence has been accumulating that Mittag falsified information crucial to economic planning. The party's control commission today rehabilitated the former director of a well-known publishing house, who was sentenced to jail in East Germany in the 1950s for counter-revolutionary activities. And the East German government released 12 films that had been banned because they were critical of the communist system. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in West Berlin.
East German visitors poured into West Germany again today when shops reopened after a one-day national holiday. West German border police said nearly 240,000 visitors flocked into that country in the first half of the day. West German officials say they plan to open four more border crossings tomorrow to deal with an expected weekend rush. El Salvador's most popular television news program did not go on the air today. The show's staff did not broadcast their program in a protest of news censorship in that country. Last night, rebel forces proposed a ceasefire in the major fighting that has struck El Salvador in the past few weeks. But as David Adams reports, the ceasefire offer is not getting a favorable response from the Salvadoran government.
The government's spokesman, Mauricio Sandoval, has said the guerrilla offer made yesterday cannot be taken seriously. He dismissed it as rebel propaganda. The guerrillas themselves have come back with a new communique, which has redefined their position. They've said that any ceasefire should be worked out through the mediation of the United Nations. That is a change on their position of yesterday, when the rebels had offered an unconditional ceasefire, which on paper had appeared to be a major change in policy. In the past, they've always said that a ceasefire should be negotiated, and there have been political demands that they've made in those negotiations, such as a cleaning out of alleged human rights abuses in the Salvadoran military. So it would appear now that the guerrillas are moving back to their position, their more traditional position held in the past.
That's David Adams in San Salvador. As many as 1,200 people have died in this latest round of fighting. This is NPR. Tadeusz Mazowiecki, the first non-communist Polish prime minister in four decades, arrived in Moscow today for a five-day visit. The Polish leader hopes to establish warm ties between the Solidarity-led government in Warsaw and communist leaders in the Soviet Union. Soviet Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov said positive developments in relations were expected from that visit. A flash fire triggered an explosion on an oil drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico early today. At least 12 people were injured, but there were no deaths reported. Officials say the rig has been shut down until an evaluation can be made of the damage. The cause of the blast has not been determined. A mother and two young children were missing today in the Gulf of Mexico after their small plane crashed in heavy seas. The children's father managed to swim to a nearby oil rig where he was rescued. An estimated 70,000 people lined Philadelphia streets to watch the country's oldest Thanksgiving Day parade today. As Christiane Viancourt from member station WHYY reports, the cold weather and snow kept many at home and caused a few problems along the parade routes.
Happy Thanksgiving! It's the first white Thanksgiving Philadelphians have celebrated in at least half a century. The 70-year-old parade had a difficult time coping with the snow and high winds. The giant Humpty Dumpty balloon had a great fall when it was punctured by a light standard along the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And the 65-foot-high Popeye looked like he had eaten a little too much spinach, spending most of the morning crawling on his hands and knees. Bob Edgar was one of a dozen balloon handlers who tried to keep Popeye upright.
It's so cold out that the heat doesn't heat up the helium and it doesn't rise, so I got lifted and carried through the whole parade.
Popeye finally made it to the art museum, where he watched Santa Claus run up the famous steps. For National Public Radio, this is Christiane Vaillancourt in Philadelphia.
A week-long summit festival of music, folk dancing, and village feasts will kick off Sunday in Malta for the summit. This is NPR. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To help celebrate the holiday, we have a special rebroadcast of a Fresh Air concert with Charles Brown. Brown likes to describe himself as a singer of blue ballads. He had 9 top 10 R&B singles between 1946 and 52, including Driftin' Blues. His popularity continued into the early 60s when his songs Merry Christmas Baby and Please Come Home for Christmas became hits. Charles Brown's work is now being rediscovered. He recorded an album in 1986 for a label that folded shortly after. That album has been reissued by Alligator Records under the title One More for the Road. But right now, it's my pleasure to introduce a live Fresh Air concert with Charles Brown. Charles Brown, a pleasure to have you here. Let me ask you to open with the song that became your first big hit back in 1946, Driftin' Blues, a song you wrote.
Yes. It moved Louis Jordan out of first place on the Cash Box magazine and Billboard. Well, I'm drifting and I'm drifting like a ship out on the sea. Drifting and I'm drifting like a ship out on the sea. Well, I ain't got nobody world to care for me. If my baby would only take me back again. If my baby only take me back again. No, I'm not good for nothing, baby. Charles Brown don't have no friend. Give you all my money. What more can I do? I'll give you all my money. What more can I do? You just a good little girl. You just won't be true. Baby, baby, bye bye, bye bye. Bye bye, baby. Baby, bye bye, bye bye. It's gonna be too late, baby. I'll be too far away. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Charles Brown. Now that we heard one of your first big hits, why don't you play something new for us?
What is
it? Play a new song for us?
Yes, I would do that, yeah. Terry. This is a tune that I had the pleasure of writing. It's called Everybody Looking for Somebody to Love, Even at My Age. So we hope you like it. I'm trying hard to find someone to love to ease my mind. Seems I have a world of trouble on my mind. This heavy load burdens me. I'm gonna lay it down so I can be free. I must find someone to love for me right now, today. Every time I read the daily news, the headline print gives me the blues. Why is there so much trouble in the times? There must be someone far away. Why, I enjoy my life till I'm old and gray. I must find someone to love for me right now, today. All my friends seem far away. There's no family love, seems it's gone away. I read the papers each and every day. That hate prevails, seems it's here to stay. I must find someone to love to ease my mind. That's all I'm thinking of. I must find someone to love for me right now, today.
That's a great song. I like that a lot.
You like that?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I want to mention to our listeners that in the 1940s, you spent a lot of time playing with Johnny Moore's
Three Blazers.
Mm-hmm. And Johnny Moore was the brother of Oscar Moore, who was the guitarist with the Nat Cole Trio.
Right. Uh-huh.
And listening to your early records, it sounds like you were really influenced by Nat Cole when you were starting out in the 40s to record.
Well, you know, we had a trio at the time. And I didn't ever go see Nat Cole.
Really?
And I didn't want to see him until I had established a style of my own. Mm-hmm. Because it's usually things wipe off on you when you hear someone else. How you sit at the piano, and I never did see him sit at the piano until I was established myself. Because actually, I didn't know what I was going to do. Because John Hopkins, who had worked with Nat Cole before, was a valet. He had told us that, Charles, this is where you should sit at the piano. So by me not seeing Nat Cole do it, but we were two trios challenging one another at the time. He was more into pop and we were into the Race record group, but we were still number one at that time. We didn't know we were going to be it, but we had the Pittsburgh Courier run a poll, and we won the poll, but Carlos Gastel said, for Nat Cole, the Blazers are not going to win the poll because I'm going to send $1,000 in there, and I'm going to beat them with the votes, so he did that.
Well, you've influenced a lot of singers, and one of the many people you've influenced was Mose Allison, who recorded one of the songs that
yeah,
you
Fool's
did,
Paradise.
Fool's Paradise. Yeah.
Yes. Sam Cooke did, too, and a lot of the other people. I don't know, John A. Fuller wrote this number. He was imitating me in San Francisco, and Leo Mester and Eddie Mester would go out as talent scouts and to find tunes that would fit me, and they heard this number being number one in San Francisco because his company that had it wasn't able to send it across the country in distribution. So he said, Charles, since they're trying to imitate you doing Fool's Paradise, why don't you do it? Then I did Fool's Paradise, and it was a great hit for me.
Would you play it for us?
Yes, I will. I often think of the life I live. It's a wonder Charles Brown indeed. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise. My mother told me, father told me too, someday my child, fate's gonna catch up with you. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise. Though I've learned my lesson, like all fools I've met, I've learned things are in this world. I remember to my dying day, my mother told me, father said it right, said Charles Brown, you're running your life. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise.
In the 1950s, you used to travel on the rhythm and blues circuit a lot, and you had a show, and as a matter of fact, Ray Charles, when he was getting started, performed in your show, opening for you,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, Ray Charles was opening for Charles Brown, and it was during the early 50s, and people thought he was singing so much like me, so was that Charles Brown? So when I came out, they said, oh no, that's Charles Brown. But at that time, I had to take Ray Charles around. In fact, all the artists that were in Shaw Agency, they were depending on me to carry them through because the promoters wanted to buy Charles Brown. But in order for Shaw to sell the other acts, he said, well, in order to get Charles Brown, you have to take the Dominoes. I took them through. I took the Clovers through. I took Ray Charles through. I took Ruth Brown, who just won the Tony Awards, through the Weinberg Tour.
Well, before we get to the next number here, I think what we'll do is take a short break. Is it? Yeah, we'll take a short break. Then we'll come back and hear more a live concert with Charles Brown. More blue ballads.
Thank you.
With Charles Brown. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We have a live concert today with Charles Brown, and you may remember many of his hits from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, his hits including Driftin' Blues and Merry Christmas Baby, Please Come Home for Christmas. He has a new album out, by the way, that was originally out in 1986, and it's just been reissued, and that's called One More for the Road. You're really making a comeback now, and I was wondering if there were periods in the late 60s and 70s, early 80s, that were difficult for you.
It was. You know, after I was banned by the Shaw Agency, they put claims against me in the union when I wanted to go see about my father. They had a lot of dates booked, and I didn't play those dates because I wanted to see about my father. So they sued me. So I was on a blacklist with the Musicians Union, and I had to go as almost a scab musician. And those were very difficult times. And a lot of promoters wouldn't pay you. They'd run out on you when they owed you money. You didn't know who they were at the ending. So I gave up. I said, look, I'm not gonna do anymore. I'm gonna retire. I'm not gonna play anymore until maybe something might come along. I said, I'm just sick of it. And I kept my piano going. I kept writing songs. I kept playing. I do my practicing every day, 1 hour, and to keep my fingers in shape. And I didn't give that up.
What started your comeback off?
Well, you know, Barry Feldman with Upside Records had sent out a notice in BMI to try to find me. And he said, Charles, the time is right for you. We would like to record you and put you back where you should be. And I considered it, and I made this first album. He produced it. He selected a lot of the tunes, and of course I had a few of my own in there. And we didn't expect it to be a big successful record because we knew what the competition was here in the United States. It was just a matter of letting the people know that you were back, you know, that you maybe hadn't lost, maybe your voice got a little heavier for time, but you hadn't lost a little of your technique.
Now, this is the record that's been reissued on Alligator.
And Alligator, after all the critics gave us an A+, and the Larry Kelp out of the San Francisco critic gave us almost a full star. He's at 3.5. You can't make a full star just when you sell a million records. But when you get 3.5, it's tops.
I'd like for you to play another song. Can I make a request here?
Yes.
This is a song you wrote?
I wrote this number, Terry, but they never gave me credit for it. I wrote Black Knight. In fact, I wrote a lot of the tunes. I didn't know about royalties. All I knew about, I wanted to play, and this would be, I thought a recording artist was just a wonderful thing to be. And I didn't know that the residuals that would come in later years about writing tunes. In fact, I would help other people, and they would put their names on it, not mine. So this is one of the tunes that you're about to ask for. What is it?
Who'd know we worked out these numbers in advance, right? Okay. This is Black Knight.
Black Knight. Nobody cares about me. Even got a friend. Baby's gonna left me. When will my troubles end? Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby. Not another day is gone. I've got no one to talk with, to tell my troubles to. Don't even know I'm living since I lost you. Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. Crying for my baby, but not another day is gone. The troubles, father has his too. brothers in Korea, I don't know just what to do. Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby, but not another day is gone.
That's terrific.
Thank you.
Well, I don't feel like we could let you leave today without playing some of Merry Christmas Baby, which is one of the songs you're best known for.
Yeah, they know me for that. No care where I go, whatever time of year, Terry.
We have about 2.5 minutes left, so let's see how as much of it as we can get in.
Okay.
Okay.
Christmas, baby, you sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby, sure did treat me nice. Gave me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise. Well, I'm feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my stereo. Feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my radio. Well, I wanna kiss you, baby. While you're standing beneath the mistletoe. Just a little part of it. We won't talk about Satan coming down the chimney yet, Terry.
Oh, I'm so sorry we're out of time. The time just flew.
It would pass so fast.
It's really been a privilege to have you here. I thank you very much.
And Terry, I want to thank you for even having me on a great program like yours, because I'd heard so much about you. We listened to it. What Danny told me, he recorded a lot of things that you did. That's when I heard it.
Well, thanks so much for coming. It was just such a real treat to have you here. My guest has been Charles Brown, who's a rhythm and blues singer and pianist. And there's a recent album of his. It was originally pressed a couple of years ago. It's been reissued. And it's called One More for the Road. It's on Alligator Records. And I understand there's a reissue that's in the works of your early recording. So that should, I suppose, be out in the next year or so.
Doing great, too. Thank you
again. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be actor Martin Short. He brought characters like Ed Grimley and Jackie Rogers Jr. to television on SCTV and Saturday Night Live. His film Three Fugitives is now out on home video. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rick Bass's passions include the wilderness, writing, and oil. Coming up, Bass discusses his latest book about his years working as a geologist searching for oil. And we talk about writing books high in the Montana wilderness. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles TK Productions, the Miami studio that recorded some of the big disco hits of the 70s. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Back to the Future 2. It's the sequel to the 1985 hit comedy about the perils of time travel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. From 250,000 to 500,000 people gathered in Prague, Czechoslovakia today, calling for democratic reforms. It was the seventh straight day of pro-reform demonstrations. Meanwhile, a senior military officer said the demands of the protesters are not realistic. Tomorrow, a crucial meeting of the Communist Party has been called to deal with the crisis. NPR's Deborah Amos has more from Prague.
Tonight, Wenceslas Square was packed again. The featured speaker was the General Secretary of the Socialist Party. He declared that as of this week, the Socialist Party was free and independent, and he called for free elections and a change in the country's leadership. The Socialist Party is part of the legal opposition and has always cooperated with the Communist Party until this week. Also today, the champion of reforms in 1968, Alexander Dubček, addressed a crowd of 100,000 people in Bratislava. Despite today's events, Communist Party hardliners appear to be marshaling their forces for tomorrow's Central Committee meeting. Tonight, a senior military officer said army leaders reject anarchy and gave strong support to the Communist Party. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
In East Germany, the Communist Party is conducting a probe of former leader Erich Honecker and expelled one of his former top aides from the party. The East German state news agency said the proceedings against Honecker and others are based on grave abuses of the party charter and responsibility for the current situation in the party and the country. Also today, Communist Party chief Egon Krenz told West German television he is ready to step down if that is the decision of next month's party congress. Polish Prime Minister Mazowiecki is in Moscow. Bridget Kendall, the BBC, reports the new Polish leader is hoping to work out a new relationship with the Soviet Union based on mutual respect.
As the rapid political transformations in Eastern Europe have snowballed over the past few weeks, the neutral and often positive way the Soviet press now treats Poland and its non-communist-led government no longer seems surprising. But Tadeusz Mazowiecki is a former solidarity activist, and not so long ago was part of Poland's illegal opposition in the Kremlin's eyes. And his visit to Moscow is still something of a milestone. He has several hours of talks scheduled with both President Gorbachev and the Soviet Prime Minister Nikolai Ryzhkov, during which both sides will no doubt be keen to establish the basis of their country's new relationship, no longer to be directed by party-to-party contacts. Moscow's new line on Eastern Europe is that it won't interfere in the sovereign affairs of another country, and the new Polish government has already announced that it intends to stay in the Warsaw Pact.
Bridget Kendall, the BBC. Israel attacked Palestinian guerrilla bases in Lebanon today, a day after the country was plunged deeper into political turmoil with the assassination of its president. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Many cultures meet in Miami. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward tells us what happened when a couple of smart guys there mixed Southern rhythm and blues with Caribbean funk.
I used to joke about the 70s being the nostalgia-proof decade and say that 1974 was a year I couldn't remember at all. Then one day I picked up one of my favorite records and realized that I could remember the summer of 1974 just fine.
Just say you wanna do it. Open up your
George McRae's Rock Your Baby was one of those perfect records, a song you heard all summer long, a song so much a part of its time that it practically defined it. Not only that, but it was just the visible tip of one hot iceberg, TK Productions of Miami. Now, a lot of the elements that made TK what it was had been around for a while, most notably Henry Stone, the grand old man of Southern Rhythm and Blues record distribution. He owned the studio that made the records. But the new talents who shot it to fame this time were a couple of white kids, Rick Finch, an engineer at TK Studios, and Harry Casey, who was the janitor. TK was in the business of making mild hits for the Southern R&B market, and it was doing okay. But Casey and Finch were young and hung out in the discos at night and knew there was another kind of music that was big all over the country. If they could just sneak some studio time, they were sure they could make a hit. So that's just what they did. Maybe that's why the sound isn't so good on Do It Good by Casey and the Sunshine Band, the name they gave their project. It got to be a big club hit locally, and the follow-up, Sound Your Funky Horn, did even better. That was when George McRae, a guy who'd been hanging around the studios and who'd been one of the voices on Do It Good, convinced Casey and Finch that it was time for him to make a record. And Rock Your Baby, propelled by a primitive drum machine, hypnotic guitar beat, and George's vocal, soared to the top of the charts, eventually selling something like 11 million copies around the world. The TK story would be impressive enough if it had stopped there, but it didn't. Soon, a couple of TK's old-line producers, Willie Clark and Clarence Reed, were in the studio with their versions of the new sound. The whole crowd got together to make what I thought was the best album of 1974, Betty Wright's Danger, High Voltage. Where Is the Love won a Grammy, and it's obviously a Casey and Finch production, but there was more. Shoo-Rah, Shoo-Rah, written by New Orleans' Alan Toussaint, is one of the greatest songs never to be a hit, and its combination of classic Southern soul horns, the up-to-date TK rhythm section, and that catchy chorus has made it a classic. As 1975 came along, TK was still incredibly strong, scoring a number one hit with Timmy Thomas's Why Can't We Live Together, another song dominated by a trashy rhythm machine. But they were beginning to repeat themselves, and soon the only act that either didn't leave or give up was Casey and the Sunshine Band. Love. That's the Way I Like It, Get Down Tonight, and other hits continued as long as the disco craze did, and in Europe even afterwards. Today, Miami's seeing another dance music renaissance with the Miami Sound Machine and other groups, but I still like to go back and listen to the low-tech sounds of TK from time to time, just to remind myself that 1974 wasn't such a waste after all.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Until a few years ago, Rick Bass was a full-time oil geologist and part-time writer. Now he writes full-time from a log cabin in a remote valley in northern Montana. Bass's first collection of short stories, The Watch, received almost unanimous critical praise. Bass's new book, Oil Notes, is a journal of his experiences working for an oil company. He writes, "Looking for oil is one of the few things in the world that is not governed by paradox. It's consistent, and you can count on it. And in general, a sturdy kind of man or woman does it. You live or die by your own lights. The rules always stay the same, though." I asked him to explain.
Pretty much the rules of physics and of geology have never changed the way rules of anything governed by sociology, rules for behaving in business or for behaving in even science. These rules change, or these boundaries, but the earth beneath us, it's the same as it's always been, and it's always going to be the same. You drill down and you'll find oil if you do things properly, and you won't find it otherwise.
Yeah, you write that it's thrilling to find oil, that it takes you over, it gets in you, it must be like belonging to a cult. I think I never thought that it would be that exciting.
Oh, it's the most exciting thing that I can imagine. It's unbelievable.
Tell me more about the excitement, because I think people think that the thrill of finding oil has to do with dollars.
Not at all. No, it's just the oil itself. It's like, that's like, dollars green are so boring, just paper, old wadded up paper that everybody's been handling and dirty and crummy. The oil is never been touched, it's never been seen, it's never been discovered, and you're the first person to find it. It's terribly exciting.
What was your best find?
I think the one I liked the best was one where we and some other companies that were in on the well, we're going to plug it. We thought there was nothing there at first. It was something we hadn't seen before, and we thought there was water down in the rock formations because it had real low resistivity, and yet the what they call the density neutron log was doing something strange that we had not seen it do before, and I was able to talk the company into trying to test it, and it turned out to be a really huge oil well. It was terribly exciting, because not only then was there the excitement of discovering the oil, there was also the excitement of having saved a reservoir that would have otherwise been plugged and maybe never found.
Do you get a commission on something like that?
I do now, because I'm working for myself. I wasn't then, which was a contention. That was I think it's a lot more fun if you're looking for oil for yourself rather than for someone else. I think it's that way in any business, though.
Mm-hmm. As exciting as it is to find oil, did you ever have an opposite reaction and feel depressed that you would be helping to deplete the remaining oil resources?
Not at all, really. I feel like it's the consumer and I am certainly a consumer, who's helping deplete the resources. The places where I explore for oil, it's in the southeastern United States, which is all private lands, and so the people that are having the wells drilled there have asked for it. I would not want to look for oil on public lands. I would feel, like you say, I wouldn't even have mixed feelings. I would feel poorly about it, because there's people who don't want oil drilling going on their public lands, and certainly that's their prerogative. But no, I never felt that feeling in the southeast. That the landowners, that's why they gave us the lease, because they wanted us to drill there. Mm-hmm. And
you write that you hate coal.
Oh, I do. I hate coal. I hate it. It's so dirty. I would rather use. I hate wood. I use wood because I live up way up in the woods, and I don't have any electricity up there, and that's the only way to keep the cabin warm. But wood and coal, it's archaic. And someday oil and gas are going to be archaic, but I think we're going backwards if we use coal. I understand that, you know, that you can use clean coal and scrub it and such, but we're just not going to do that. That's, I don't believe we have the discipline or the to do that. So I think we should just, you know, realize our limits and use oil and gas, which is the cleanest thing we have at present. And then, you know, when we run out of that, we should be developing other sources right now. That's kind of a melancholy or pathos of the industry right now. I think this is like about the last generation of geologists that we'll see in this country, and we'll have to go to other forms of energy in the next generation. And so it's kind of the, you know, a swan song, and that makes it even sweeter looking for oil and gas, knowing that, you know, people, it'll be a lost profession probably in the next generation, if not sooner.
If looking for oil is so exciting to you, how come you left?
To write. Writing is also exciting, and I couldn't do both full-time. And I don't ever want to not be looking for oil and gas. I'll probably work in one or two prospects a year just so that I'm able to stay in it. I keep my maps current, and I stay up with what's going on, but I don't throw myself into it the way that I used to. I try and throw myself into the writing now.
Now, while you were a full-time geologist, you used to drive 36 hours in order to spend 57 hours in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah, even more unbalanced than that. Sometimes I would drive longer to spend shorter times.
Now you actually live in the wilderness.
Yes.
Would you describe where you live?
Sure. It's in the small valley right up on the Canadian line in northwestern Montana. It's heavily timbered. It's like the Pacific Northwest. It's not so much like the Rocky Mountains. It's more northwest. There's extensive logging going on in my valley, which is disturbing really large clear cuts, but it's kind of like oil. You know, the valley won't be wild forever, but right now it's still pretty wild. There's all kinds of wildlife. We see bear and mountain lions and coyotes and wolves and deer and elk and moose come down in the backyard every day. It's like 100 years ago. It's a nice wild valley for now. The rivers are still clean and pretty.
Is the wilderness as exciting to you now that you're living in it full time and it's not something out there that you have to go to, you know, take a lot of time to get to?
Yes, I'm glad to say that it is. It's still, every day it just gets better. It becomes more and more important to me, even the longer I'm in it, which is nice. You would suspect or think that, you know, maybe it would dilute or wane, but it just becomes more and more important to me each day.
Do you have an electric typewriter or a computer to write on?
I write in the greenhouse on paper with a pen, but I do have an electric typewriter, which I can run with a generator. And so whenever I have to type what I've written, I'll crank that up and run it for 2 or 3 hours in the evenings.
You have no phone, right?
Right. I've got a radio, but no phone, a shortwave radio that runs off a battery.
How do you communicate with editors, not only your book editors, but you've also over the years written a lot for magazines?
Yes, I really like communicating by mail. I think it's the best way, and it's the most natural way. I think phones and certainly these fax machines now, they're too fast. They demand too quick of a decision. And I think, you know, it's going to sound really old-fashioned, but I think it's almost an insidious thing that, you know, I understand that they're great life-saving technology sometimes, but also I think we can lean too heavily on that kind of high-speed living and let it alter our lives in a way we may not yet be developed for. So to answer your question, by mail when I can.
Where is the line for you that separates solitude from loneliness?
Boy, I haven't found it in so long. I couldn't answer that right now. I mean, it's a lot farther out there than it used to be. So I guess what I'm saying is solitude is becoming more and more important to me every day. You know, I haven't been lonely, and I don't know when. And, you know, it would take an awful lot of solitude to reach that point, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's so little solitude left anymore.
What's the worst trouble you've been in living in the wilderness?
It's a good question. There was one day that just stands out, very easy to answer. I cut my leg with a chainsaw, and Elizabeth set herself on fire within, like, 30 minutes of each other.
Gosh.
It was in the winter, and the roads were real bad. It had rained and then frozen, and so the roads were icy. I shouldn't have even been out, but I was down cutting wood, really just to stay warm because it was so cold. And I cut my leg with a chainsaw, not badly, but enough to really scare me. And so I drove on home, and I drove up in the driveway, and Elizabeth's standing out in the snow in her nightgown, and it's, you know, it's charred, it's around her knees or ankles, and she's just standing there in shock with her arms around herself. So she had been standing next to the fire in a cotton nightgown trying to get warm, and a spark had popped through the screen and had it caught her gown. And she saw the reflection at first of the gown in the window and thought it was my headlights driving up, and because it was right at dusk. And then they got larger and larger, and she realized that she's on fire, and she ran out and rolled in the snow. And that was when we said, look, we better shape up and realize where we are and take better care.
What did you do that day? Did you get yourself to a hospital?
No, mine wasn't cut that badly, and her burns weren't that bad. Mostly the burns were on her hands where she'd slapped the fire out. But if either of us had been injured badly, we would have had to go in on the bad road, which, you know, we have chains on our tires, and it could have been done, but it's just better not to do it.
So when you decided you had to realize where you were and get in shape for it, what changes did you make?
Just mental changes. We had prepared for the winter with equipment, you know, having backup generator, backup wood supply, backup saw, backup everything, backup truck even. But mentally, you know, not being tired, just being more alert that things may not always go the way you want them to go.
You know, I think it's a kind of nightmare of some writers that they're going to change their life, leave their job, and get to a place where they can write uninterrupted. And then they're going to get there. Now that they have all this time, they're going to find they can't write. Did you ever have that fear yourself?
I think my nightmare is just, I think mine's more broad than that, just that anywhere I am, I would not be able to write. And I think I looked at it, if I weren't writing, well, I would rather be in the wilderness not writing than in a city not writing. So I don't even get that specific with the nightmare. But, uh-huh. And I suppose I would be happier. Well, I know I'd be happier not writing here than not writing somewhere else. And I think that's so I don't worry about that.
Well, Rick Bass, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much.
Rick Bass's new book, Oil Notes, is published by Houghton Mifflin. He spoke to us from KUFM in Missoula, Montana. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll have news from Czechoslovakia, El Salvador, and Lebanon. And we're celebrating Thanksgiving. It's a holiday for newcomers. We'll talk to Mexican immigrants and to immigrants to the United States from the Philippines, middle-class people taking working-class jobs to stay in America. If your Thanksgiving turkey looked a little lopsided, you might listen to the advice of our food stylist, but keep in mind that most of what she prepares, while it's lovely to look at, probably would not be safe to eat. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The movie Back to the Future Part 2 has just opened. Many of the actors from the original Back to the Future reprise their roles. Michael J. Fox is back as Marty McFly, Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown. Critic Owen Gleiberman has this review.
In Back to the Future Part 2, Michael J. Fox journeys from 1985 into the year 2015, then back to 1985 again, then back to 1955. But it's not just Fox who gets hurled around the space-time continuum. The whole movie hurtles from scene to scene, as though it were scared of slowing down long enough to let you breathe. Director Robert Zemeckis knows that those who've grown up in the Lucas Spielberg era have very quick minds, and that no one ever accused them of being overly sensitive. With Back to the Future 2, he's come up with a big, ungainly contraption of a movie, kind of like the B-1 bomber. In the first and most enjoyable section, Marty McFly and his wild-haired mentor, Doc Brown, step into their time-traveling DeLorean and journey to the early 21st century, only to discover a Hill Valley, California that looks like an Archie Comics version of Blade Runner. As you might expect, Zemeckis has a ball conjuring up eerily familiar futuristic details. We get flying skateboards, retro-punk fashions that have grown even more chicly primitive, and a nostalgia bar called the Cafe 80s. As it turns out, Doc has brought Marty to this brave new world for a purpose.
Don't talk to anyone. Don't touch anything. Don't do anything. Don't interact with anyone. And try not to look at anything.
I don't get it. I thought you said this had something to do with my kids.
Look what happens to your son.
My son? God, he looks just like me. Within 2 hours of his arrest, Martin McFly Jr. was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 15 years in the state penitentiary? Within 2 hours?
The justice system works swiftly in the future now that they've abolished all lawyers.
That business about Marty saving his son turns out to be a red herring. The real plot hinges on a book of sports trivia Marty wants to take back to the present so he can make a killing betting on games. The trivia book ends up falling into the hands of Biff Tannen, that same Stone Age bully Marty's father had to fight off in the first movie. Biff steals the time machine and takes the book back to his younger self in 1955. Are you with me? Now, young Biff can use the book to become the richest man in the world. This one change alters the entire history of Hill Valley. Instead of the pleasant community Marty remembers, it turns into a poverty row sleaze pit, which the greedy Biff now reigns over like a king. Only Marty can alter its destiny. If this sounds a little familiar, that's because it's been taken directly from the nightmare sequence of It's a Wonderful Life. But the comparison breaks down pretty quickly. In the first Back to the Future, you cared about whether Marty was going to coax his father out of permanent wimpitude. Here, the business with Marty saving the future of Hill Valley is just an abstract device, a way of letting Zemeckis cram the movie with gimmicky juxtapositions. You can tell Zemeckis made this film after the exhaustingly inventive Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Back to the Future 2 is so busy and all over the place, I kept expecting Marty to take a detour through Toontown. The plot is satisfyingly complicated, only this time it doesn't really grow out of the characters. Crispin Glover's surreal gangliness is sorely missed. Instead, we get far too many of Biff's ranting tirades. Still, that's typical of this era, in which even the most talented filmmakers are becoming manic, hectoring entertainers, always trying to blast us into the pop stratosphere. Back to the Future 2 gets the job done, but it's a machine-tooled movie that pummels you with fun. Sitting through it is like watching a video game compete with itself.
Owen Gleiberman is a Boston-based writer and critic. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Lander. All our engineers are Richard Parker, Bob Alls, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Long before Martin Short did his impressions of Jerry Lewis on SCTV and Saturday Night Live, long before he created the character of Ed Grimley, Short hosted an imaginary TV variety show in his bedroom. On the next Fresh Air, The Martin Short Show. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.